Countrywide on ABC Radio.
I'm absolutely calling on the Deputy Prime Minister to pay attention to his own report.
Growers work from sun up to sun down, so...
Countrywide.
We need to speak to these growers 1 o'clock in the morning.
And to actually act on behalf of the farmers.
They're going to get it from the Yanks or the French or whoever. So let's get our foot in the door and let's be the first.
Countrywide. The politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
G'day. Welcome to Countrywide. I'm John Daly. This week, Australia's first case against the weed killer Roundup.
Now, look, there's quite a bit of literature out there, a lot of studies showing that this particular product is harmful with a significant exposure.
And Coles has announced it's going to start buying its milk direct from dairy farmers.
Given that the incentives are there for farmers to supply Coles, I imagine it is a competitive marketplace, but they will be able to find willing sellers.
And WA pastoralists are taking their fight against wild dogs to the sky.
I've started to think about getting in there by air.
That's a little bit later on Countrywide, but first, let's have a look at that landmark case against agricultural giant Monsanto, because Melbourne gardener Michael Ogliarolo has launched legal action against Monsanto, claiming his cancer was caused by exposure to the very commonly used weed-killing chemical glyphosate. And it's the first time an Australian has launched legal action against Monsanto. It comes hard on the heels of those three successful claims against the company in the US. Now, Mr. Ogliarolo is being represented by Tony Carboni, Managing Director of Carboni Lawyers. And Mr. Carboni is confident in his client's case.
What our client's saying is that between 1997 and until recently, he was working as a landscape gardener, and he had heavy exposure to the mixing of the Roundup product to dilute them, applying the Roundup products on lawns and plants, and working in the vicinity of people that are using Roundup products. So what we're saying is, due to the heavy exposure, no warnings on the label to say, look, you know, wear a mask or wash your hands, do this, do that. He subsequently, in 2011, was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that is a blood disease, leukemia.
And how will you prove in court that glyphosate was the cause of that cancer?
There's been quite a few cases overseas in America. There's been three successful proceedings already. There's a body of evidence where there's been quite a few studies conducted, and they've said that glyphosate is carcinogenic in nature and can cause these cancers, especially blood-related cancers. So we're going to need oncologists and medical experts to say, on a balance of probabilities, our client's condition was caused by the exposure to glyphosate.
In the US, we've seen that the Environment Protection Agency has ruled that glyphosate is not carcinogenic, and we've seen the same thing here with the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority making the same ruling. How will you argue against those rulings?
No, look, you've got to remember, in the States, there's been three decisions in favour of plaintiffs. There've been very, very big judgments. The UN has found that active Roundup ingredients is carcinogenic glyphosate. The French have banned the use of the Roundup. So, now look, there's quite a bit of literature out there, a lot of studies showing that this particular product is harmful with significant exposure, which is what is the case with our client.
Have you had inquiries from other potential complainants? And...
Yeah, there's been quite a few people ringing up saying that they've developed blood disorders and things like that due to significant exposure.
If this case was successful, what sort of precedent would it set?
Oh, look, if it was successful, it would be huge, because let's be realistic. The amount of people using Roundup, especially your farmers, your gardeners, people working in councils, it'd be absolutely massive.
Andrew Wiedemann, Chairman of Grain Producers Australia and a farmer in Western Victoria, says the case is unsurprising but deeply concerning. He says glyphosate is a safe product that's necessary to feed a growing world population.
Well, look, I think this was always going to happen, Angus, and at some point in time there'll probably be various cases mounted around the world based on what was happening in America. And, of course, from the farmer's perspective, obviously we're deeply concerned about the issue that's facing us with this continual run against glyphosate by people that have obviously got cancer and were certainly concerned for their welfare. But in this particular case, when you look at the science, and that's what we've been focusing on at the moment, the regulation and the regulatory authorities have approved it as a safe product for us to use. We believe as farmers and talking to other farmers that it's probably the most safest product that we use in our own minds. So this is certainly, from the farmer's perspective, something that we're all very, very concerned about and the potential that it may have on food security globally.
In Victoria, the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning is reviewing its use of glyphosate on public land. What do you make of that review?
Well, look, yes, I'm aware of the review, and it's based on people, again, looking at the management and the protocols around the usage of it and ensuring that their staff are well-trained to use the product. And I think, again, like any product we're using, we should read the label, understand what we're using, and make sure that people are aware of any particular hazards around any particular chemical and wearing the appropriate PPE gear that most people have been trained in that have had or do have a licence to use and operate with agricultural chemicals.
Is there anything the industry can do, whether that's Grain Producers Australia or farmers, to defend the use of glyphosate, or do you think the science will speak for itself?
Well, look, no, I think that farmers in general should be speaking up to their local politicians. I believe that, you know, we'll be trying to sit down with Bridget McKenzie as soon as possible to discuss this. And I think that from Australia's perspective, but a global perspective, there needs to be a roundtable of agricultural leaders to actually work through what the landscape would look like if we had or lost this for global activity in terms of food production, because if we're going to start starving people and making food too expensive for people to have, then I've got a bigger concern around that than I have anything to do with the use of glyphosate in my own business. And I think the one thing to remember here, of course, is that our farming areas are also our family areas. And I think if there was any concern for our families, then we would be not using any products that would inhibit that.
That was Andrew Wiedemann, Chairman of Grain Producers Australia, ending that report from Angus Verley.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Now to the dairy industry, where supermarket giant Coles is cutting out the middleman, so to speak, because the retailer has announced it's going to start buying milk directly from farmers. And that's not through a processor, as has been the case in the past. Now, Nikolai Bailharts spoke to food consultant and director of Fresh Agenda, Joe Bills.
Look, it's not unprecedented. Woolworths have actually done a similar thing, not exactly the same mechanism, but they've had their farmer's own milk that was started back in 2013 in the Manning Valley in New South Wales. And they do directly contract with farmers to supply that particular private label brand of theirs.
So what do you see as the lure for supermarkets to move to this model where, in a sense, you're kind of cutting out the middleman to a degree, you are cutting out the processor?
Certainly in the UK, it's very widespread that supermarkets have direct contracts with suppliers for milk and other dairy products. And part of that in the UK is being able to manage things like transparency in their supply chain and maybe, you know, ask for certain processes to be done or standards to be met in that supply base. But probably in Australia, the issue's been really around a dollar a litre milk and some of the PR fallout that the major retailers have worn for that pricing strategy. And certainly with Farmers Own, Woolworths was looking to ensure that the farmers that were directly supplying them had a bit more security and a higher price to supply those products. Coles' solution at the time was to contract that home brand contract with the biggest farmer-owned cooperative in Murray Goulburn, but obviously Murray Goulburn no longer being there, I guess they're looking for a different solution.
Mm. And I imagine too one of the challenges that potentially Coles faces is, as you say, a number of dairy farmers still blame the supermarkets, and it's not exclusive to Coles, but a lot of dairy farmers do blame the troubles the industry's been in because of things like dollar a litre milk. Will it be hard for Coles to get supply, do you think?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there is, you know, an issue for Coles in terms of their image, I guess, with suppliers, but certainly Woolworths, who obviously have also ranged the dollar a litre milk along with Aldi and everybody else, they don't seem to have had a huge problem in accessing willing suppliers. They've rolled it out, you know, quite slowly over the years. But, you know, from what we've heard around the traps, the suppliers that are contracted to Woolworths are quite happy with the arrangement. And given that the incentives are there for farmers to supply Coles, I imagine they... it is a competitive marketplace, but they will be able to find willing sellers.
Mm, and I guess all of that is contingent on the price, which is one of the main things that was missing from today's release. We don't know what price Coles is willing to pay.
No, they haven't disclosed that in the release, which is perhaps understandable. But I guess the big pitch in what Coles is doing is that there's a bit of security in terms of the number of years that you can be contracted, and a price for 2 years guaranteed, and then a bit of certainty on the third year. And so that's probably quite attractive for some farmers that want to lock that in long-term rather than ride the volatile commodity markets.
It's an interesting move from Coles too, in the sense that I'd imagine it creates a fair bit more work for them, because if you're drawing up a whole lot of contracts and dealing directly with farmers, you're going to have people be a bit more hands-on than if you're just dealing with one processor.
Yeah, look, that's right. And it's not 100% clear from the release how they're going to actually do that. Obviously, Saputo, they've said, who have taken over the assets of Murray Goulburn, are going to continue to process that milk for Coles. But in terms of how it works with contracting with farmers, with Woolies, they do use not exactly a broker, but a middleman to manage those issues. But it's not clear how exactly Coles will approach that. But it is, as you say, quite complex.
Should it be a bit of a worry for processors, broadly speaking, that would they be thinking, oh, gee, I hope we're still going to have a role to play in 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's an interesting one. Obviously, at this stage, it's just fresh milk. And for most of the processors, Saputo, Fonterra and the like, they've got a business beyond fresh milk. But, you know, Coles has flagged in this release that they're also looking at perhaps sourcing other dairy products in the same way. So it's a toll processing arrangement for the processors. They will still have to be involved in some way, but I guess it's up to each business model whether it's an attractive proposition for them to do that with a retailer or not, or try and compete for that milk and service other markets. So it'll be an interesting and very competitive and complex space for dairy sourcing.
That was Director of Fresh Agenda, Joe Bills, ending that report by Nikolai Bailharts. Now, a world-first mango sorting machine has been designed and tested in central Queensland, and it's vying to take some of the grunt, some of the hard work out of mango harvesting. Now, the machine uses cameras, sensors, and special grabs to pick only the ripe, tasty fruit from the tree. And farmer Ian Grove's mango trees were the guinea pigs for the initial trials of this robot. And he says it could offer a pretty novel solution to labour shortages in the industry.
It's got huge potential for the future, Amy. It's still at its first stage, so they only got here right at the end of the season, and we had a few keep mangoes left on. We left some there for them, and they did their trial work until they had a computer issue, had to take it back to the university to keep doing more trials up there.
Bit of a sneak peek, though, at the future, perhaps. What did you think?
Yeah, I think once it gets worked, a bit more speed and a bit more accuracy, which Kerry and the crew are working on as we speak, pretty much. Once it gets there, it really does have a future potential for making life a little bit easier for us on the farm.
One of those big benefits that Professor Walsh spoke about to me was the reduction of the reliance on workers. Is that something that gets you a bit excited?
Oh, absolutely. Mango growing is a thing where you need a whole lot of workers for a short period of time. So 4 to 6 weeks, and you've got to bring in a whole crew, train them up, keep them here, keep them happy, and work in what are pretty hot and torrid conditions for the season. So if we can cut back the number, they'd have to work out in the hot sun and basically have that fruit picked with a lot less people, then it'll be a tremendous step forward.
at the moment they're working on integrating what they have into the other machinery that you use at this time of year, during harvest time. What other things do you think they need to work on?
Oh, well, right now I think the team up there have done, this is their third big thing for the mango industry. The first was the near-infrared Felix meter that tests the maturity of the fruit while it's still on the tree so we can get our harvest dates a bit better. The other one that they've been working on is the lights computer checking on the flower development and then the fruit counting as the crop comes along, which gives us a very accurate number of fruit in the field so we can order the right number of cartons, get the right number of people to pick and pack, and down to the size of the fruit. So that's been coming along the last 2 years, and now he's working on this auto harvester, which picked the first fruit this year. So that's sort of excitement for the step three that the crew are working on.
So CQU's done some great work for the mango industry.
They sure have, and I like to put it out there. We have everyone in Katherine or Darwin or the Burdekin or Mareeba saying that's the capital. They all think they're the capital of the mango industry, but Rockhampton down here with CQU and the work that Professor Walsh Kerry's been doing up there puts us in a pretty important position in the mango industry, not forgetting that the Honey Gold Mango came from Rockhampton as well.
So you're pretty proud of it all?
Oh, I think we have a lot to be proud of. Have the team up there working on such futuristic things that will take our industry forward in leaps and bounds. I think we should be very proud of the progress they're making.
It's cool as well as a grower for you to be able to be involved, right? To be able to, I mean, you could always say that you were the first grower to have a mango harvesting machine on your property.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's exciting to see the team as they work by. They've been coming down for 2 years and doing different things on the farm. It's to be able to work with them and offer any bits of advice, such as they are, about where we think that we need to be going with these things.
It was Queensland mango farmer Ian Groves speaking there with Amy McCosker. And if you'd like to read more about that pretty impressive robot and also see it in action, you can head to an online article on the ABC Rural website. That's abc.net.au/rural.
Countrywide, the voice of regional Australia on ABC Radio.
Now to the wine industry, because the ACCC has uncovered major bargaining power imbalances between large winemakers and the small growers who operate in the warmer, higher producing wine regions of Australia. Now this interim report found a lack of transparency that ultimately stifled the price that growers received. The Commission says growers also fear reprisals if they complain about the prices they receive. Here's Mick Keogh, Deputy Chair of the ACCC, speaking to rural reporter Angus Verley.
About 18 months ago, the ACCC was conducting some stakeholder consultations about the Horticulture Code of Conduct. A key issue that was raised with us repeatedly in those meetings was concerns of wine grape growers, particularly in the warm climate grape regions. So that's the Riverina, the Murray around Mildura and the Riverlands in South Australia, about the imbalances in that industry, particularly in their contractual arrangements with major winemakers. So the ACCC undertook to carry out a more detailed inquiry and to look at competition and contracting practices in that industry, and this is the result.
That inquiry's been undertaken. What issues were uncovered?
The first one is the contracting arrangements between wine grape growers and winemakers in those regions. There's quite a deal of involved contractual obligations that make it very difficult for wine grape growers to switch, for example, between wineries. So their long notice periods, detailed requirements before they can switch, all those sorts of things. The second issue is quality assessments. So growers are paid on the basis of quality assessments, but they're very subjective. There's only limited adoption of objective, measured information about the quality of wine grapes that are delivered. The third thing is price transparency. It's very common that winemakers refuse to allow wine grape growers to talk about the prices they've been offered. So they take a lot of steps to try and make sure growers don't get the opportunity to compare prices. And then payment periods is a further issue. Many wine grape growers don't get paid in full for up to 9 months after they deliver the grapes. All these measures have been looked at in the past, and the industry had developed a voluntary code. And to some extent that has worked, and we acknowledge that. The limitation is that a number of the major winemakers have not signed up to that voluntary code.
So given those issues that have been uncovered, is this a case of growers being ripped off?
Look, it's hard to tell. I mean, I think the biggest issue is the lack of competition that growers have faced and continue to face for their grapes. So it's not uncommon, for example, for winemakers to say that if a grower stops supplying them and goes somewhere else, they will never allow them to go back. So there's a very strong code of almost retribution for growers who try to seek out a better price for their grapes.
We've talked about the issues. Now if we could focus on solutions, could you talk me through what the ACCC is recommending?
Well, we've recommended the industry make serious efforts to adopt objective, measured quality assessments to the extent that that's possible. We've also made some recommendations that all major winemakers should be required to transmit their interim price to a central body on a particular date, and then that information be made available to all grape growers so that they can make sensible decisions in full information about where they want to allocate their grapes to. We've recommended that payment periods be phased back to what is standard in every other industry, which is just 30 days. They shouldn't have to wait 9 months to get payment for their grapes. And we've also recommended that a number of changes be made to the voluntary code of conduct, and that all major winemakers who crush more than 10,000 tonnes should be signatories to that. And if that doesn't happen, there would be serious questions why the government wouldn't look at making the code mandatory for those wineries.
That was Mick Keogh, Deputy Chair of the ACCC, speaking to Angus Verley. Now to WA, because sheep producers with wild dog problems may soon be able to call in a drone to bait and track the pests. Now, wild dogs are an issue for pastoralists because they attack stock. And two West Australian men are building a helicopter drone that can fly for 2 hours, and it has some pretty fancy military-grade hardware which can fly over some remote areas to detect dogs via their heat signals. Now, sheep producer Maine Janor is new to WA's pastoral industry, but he says the idea of using drone technology to access the most rugged terrain of his station came to him when he was throwing baits out of the ute window.
This is Woodgelong Pool. It's a water supply that we've got on the station. We've been in there before and seen a whole heap of dead kangaroos all over there, you know, up on the rocks and down in the creek. So we figured there was a wild dog working in the area. So there's a lot of these water holes all around the station.
Mm-hmm.
In some places you can get to them and in other places you can't, yeah. So I started to think about getting in there by air.
So eventually you, in your research, connected with Nigel.
Yeah, just through a friend of a friend, and I was just talking about it, and he said, oh, I know a bloke that builds his own drones, and they're quite big and they fly for a long time. So I gave Nigel a call.
What were you thinking, Nigel, when this bloke rung up and said, I've got this great idea?
Oh, look, I mean, we get so many people throughout the years of droning, you know, ring us up with ideas and concepts, and it really wasn't until we got here to see, you know, the scale, you know, of the landscape and the difficulties associated with, you know, the wild dog issue, that we could visualise a system to suit it. Our idea is that it, you know, we make the system as, you know, autonomous as possible. Currently, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, the system is just programmed from your computer or the onboard tablet. A flight plan set up within the PC. Trigger points are set for the payload, depending on what we're using at the time, whether it's a bait dispenser or, you know, thermal imaging cameras or day-night view cameras. And the system will take off, fly the mission itself, dispense baits at those locations, and then come back to base station and land again for refueling. And yeah.
So it's going to automatically drop a bait if it senses a dog?
Yeah, so we're working with, you know, vision recognition software to see, can we, you know, feature profile what a dog looks like as opposed to, say, a sheep or a cattle. What sensor is going to be best suitable from that. Obviously, we're looking to try and fly as high as we can to cover as much ground as possible. And then that limitates then what type of sensor we can carry. Obviously, flying close to the ground, we get very, very good detail, but only see a narrow field of view. So the idea is to try and fly as high as we can, you know, at least 120 metres, so we're sort of sitting, you know, at the upper level of CASA's 400 feet rule to get us the biggest ground coverage with the sensor.
Does that technology already exist? It's just finding out what is going to work best here in that environment.
Yeah, there's a lot of development, you know, on thermal imaging and day-night view, you know, particularly from the military backgrounds. So we're looking at those sensors and where's the happy medium for the altitude we're trying to fly at. And obviously the resolution we're trying to see is very detailed. So the best sensor within that scope and obviously budget of the program to make that a reality.
So did you have to get permission to bring in some of the technology that you're looking at?
Yeah, so some of the sensors and equipment that we're, you know, purchasing do have military defence clearance. So we have to get, you know, customs clearance and permits to bring those into the country.
Mayne, what do you imagine as someone who wants to have more sheep here and knows you've got there's a broader dog problem in this area? What do you see this drone doing?
Oh, yeah, I see it like as an eye in the sky, so we can send it up there at night time with its thermal imaging camera, start to find out where the dogs are, where they're coming from, where they're going, find the corridors, the highways, where most of them are drinking. Find dens, and from then have a more targeted approach to dog control, and working with our local doggers as well. So we'll be able to say to them, oh look, we've found these couple of dogs over here, do you want to set your traps up here rather than go up the top end where we haven't found any? And sort of just to make our resources a bit more efficient. So the idea is when the aircraft's in the air, it's not just doing one job. So it's not just looking for dogs, it's measuring other things as well. So it's looking for land degradation, it's looking for where your stock are through the smart tag system, and checking windmills and water troughs and fence lines. And so once it's in the air, you're sort of just doing a lot of different applications at once.
That was WA pastoralist Mayne Janor speaking to ABC's Joe Prendergast, and that's it for Countrywide this week. You can read more about that story and plenty others online on our website, abc.net.au/rural. You can also podcast this program and plenty more from the ABC Rural team. But for now, I'm John Daly. Thanks for listening.